Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
I've said it is kind of a good problem to have.
What problem is that? Jace Hefner with the U.S. Grains Council.
Roughly 60 to 70% of all the sorghum produced in the United States is exported. And of that 60 to 70%, 80% of it is consumed and purchased by the Chinese. So they love it. They know that it's great. And it's mostly used in hog and animal feed, but fluctuating year to year, about 30% of it does go into the Chinese Baijiu market. And there is a huge appetite. It's not slowing down. And so even though the market may look slow at this time, I'd urge people to keep in mind that there is still a 500,000 tons on the books that hasn't been shipped yet, just due to tight availability. But once this, we're about 40 days away from the South Texas harvest. Once that comes online, you're going to be continuing to see vessel after vessel go to China, just as in previous years.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
No.
When asked if he ever thought he'd be writing a farm bill, Chairman of the House Ag Committee, G.T. Thompson.
No, I hadn't. What a privilege and an honor to be able to do that, though, on behalf of all those hardworking families that are a part of America's number one industry. So I'm, I got to pinch myself sometimes to the place that I'm in and the responsibility that comes with it to not just get a farm bill done, but to get it done in a right way, you know, that does the right things to support in a robust way America's number one industry of agriculture.
He says getting any legislation passed today requires a bipartisan effort.
Farm bill is kind of a must-do piece of legislation, obviously, and we always eventually get it done. Now, they all have their own detours and potholes and things they have to navigate. And this has been no different. The complexities this time around have been really interesting. You know, the firing of a Speaker of the House and just, you know, some of the different things that we're facing. We need to look and see how strong of a bipartisan vote. It's definitely a bipartisan bill. You know, the question is how bipartisan is the vote? And that will dictate the pathway to the House floor. It obviously needs the floor. I'm confident that, you know, we'll get it to the House floor. I just need to look at the end of the day on Thursday or maybe Friday. We'll see how long it goes, to see what is the most appropriate pathway there.
Still has to pass the House, the Senate, work through a conference committee, and signed into law. Can it happen?
I think we do. Now, I mean, the Senate does not have a bill yet, obviously. They've been doing some listening as well, and they have a collection of individual pieces of legislation that people have proposed. But I've got confidence in in Senator Stabenow and Senator Bozeman that they'll be working on putting their bill together. We'll get ours passed out of committee on Thursday. I'll find a pathway to the House floor. But I do think there is time. And there's some urgency here, too, that I hope that everyone understands. You know, when it comes to funding, we want to roll the monies under the Inflation Reduction Act into the Farm Bill baseline. Because right now, whatever goes out the door by Secretary Vilsack, it's a once and done. And right now, it's probably about $13 billion. Originally, it was $20 billion. I think we're talking about $13 billion now. The sooner we can get this farm bill done under my proposal, and I think the Senate's in agreement with this, and we can put it in the farm bill baseline, then that money actually would be there for every future farm bill. You get around to 2050, 2055, we still have those additional dollars that would reoccur with every farm bill. And it would be invested in conservation. And that's what I'm doing with it. When we roll it into the farm bill baseline, I want invested in the baseline. I'd like to be able to stick with what we know works, which is locally led, incentive-based, and voluntary. Those have been great tools that have really helped our farmers be climate heroes, you know, through those conservation programs.
But says it's a team effort.
You know, I had somebody come up to me, Nate, and said, congratulations on your bill. And I had to correct them. It's our bill, right? We built this as a farm team, you know, from coast to coast, actually in Puerto Rico, too. I'm really proud of this bipartisan product.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
You might think that determining feed or forage intake in a beef cow is simple.
How much do cattle consume? Dave Lallman, Oklahoma State beef cattle specialist.
As it turns out, it's quite difficult. And we are uniquely situated and equipped to do that kind of research here at Oklahoma State University. Many years ago, the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine published an equation to estimate feed or forage intake in a beef cow. And so that work was done 30 plus years ago, or at least the data used in the equation was published a long time ago. So it turns out that estimating feed intake in beef cows is one of our specialties here at the Range Cow Research Center. And so we just recently published a paper where we have taken many different experiments that we've conducted here and others have conducted other places around the country and pulled those together and tried to determine if the old equation the National Academy of Sciences is using is accurately estimating feed intake in beef cows. What we've learned is that it does a pretty good job. The old equation does a pretty good job when the quality of feed or forage is very low. But as quality, you know, average quality or high quality forage or high quality mixed diet, that old equation was really underestimating feed intake in modern beef cows. What is the difference and why does it matter? Well, I think, you know, the primary usefulness of an accurate estimate of feed intake is to use it to estimate nutrient requirements of a beef cow, say for winter supplementation, making sure they have adequate protein and energy. The other use of an equation like that is for some of the breed associations to use their multi-trait selection indexes. So what is the cost of a cow? What's the cost of a 1,500-pound cow versus a 1,000-pound cow? Well, in order to estimate the difference in cost, you have to have an accurate estimate of feed intake. So what we discovered is that the old equation is basically predicting that on average, an average quality forage, a cow would consume somewhere in the neighborhood of about 26 pounds per day, 26.3 to be exact. And the new equation we developed from this work indicates that those cows are actually consuming on average about 31 pounds of feed or forage per day. Well, forage and average quality forage per day. So that's about a 15% increase in forage intake in modern beef cows compared to what that old National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, Medicine equation estimated. Having an accurate estimate of feed intake in a modern beef cow is important because, you know, you have to know what an animal is going to consume before you can determine if they're receiving adequate amount of protein and energy. So there's a summary of the recent publication that involves a lot of the work we've done over the last few years. But let me tell you, that's just the tip of the iceberg on details related to things that influence intake in a beef cow. And so if you'd like to dig into that a little bit more, just go to the sunup.okstate.edu.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We have the Social Security Trust Fund exhausted in 2033 within the budget window. There's multiple hundreds of billions of dollars in such as the gap between the resources available to the system and the benefits that have been promised. Medicare is not much further behind.
Director of the Congressional Budget Office is Philip Schwagel.
So, you know, since the fiscal situation is daunting, I left the debt to GDP chart on the screen for a variety of reasons that I've gone through. In such as the numbers are yet more challenging than what are reflected in our most recent projections. We'll have new projections coming out in June.
Which can seem like an eternity. Also sounding the warning bell, Arizona Representative David Schweikert.
Very few people here have ever paid much attention to Medicare and how we finance it. And where does the money come from? You had the president behind that podium that made it sound like, don't, we're never going to touch Medicare, or you're not allowed to talk about Social Security, and we're going to actually raise these taxes for Medicare. You got to understand, you see this red area there? Think of that as Medicare Part A. That's the trust fund. That's when you pay your payroll tax, a little slice of that goes to this right here. That's the trust fund that bounces up and down. So one day it's 6 years away from running out. Now it's 2035 because of some changes and good employment in the economy. But it's really sensitive. This blue here, most folks don't understand. The majority here, the biggest single slice of the pie of Medicare comes right out of the general fund. So when we talk about healthcare costs going up, they're already up over 7% this year. Excuse me, 10% this year. Tax receipts are up 7, but Medicare costs are up 10. That's a huge hit on the general fund. And over here, you see this, that's actually premiums, and then here's some actual state transfers and those things, some of the dual eligibles and some of those things. But you have a lot of folks who run around here somehow thinking Medicare is financed off the FICA tax, the payroll tax. And it's not. It's about a third of the spending. And why that's important is the actuary report that came out yesterday actually was okay on Medicare. We gained a few years, but the reason, if you really dig into it, it's these minute changes and, I believe, unrealistically optimistic numbers that healthcare costs are going to stabilize, even though this year Medicare costs are up 10%. So I don't know how they justified those two numbers. Guess what I'm going to do the next week or two? We're going to read every line and try to figure out what they were saying in here. Welcome to my life. But when you see this Part A here? Now we're doing it in blue. That's actually part of your payroll tax. The Part B and Part D, those are substantially coming out of the general fund. So it turns out Medicare is, you know, the biggest single, excuse me, other than interest, is the biggest spend out of the general fund. Because Social Security, until the trust fund's gone, does not have a general fund aspect. Social Security is self-financed right now. It's payroll tax and trust fund. But that's why so many of us are freaked out that is it 8 years, 9 years? Is it now 2035 or 2034? And we're going to get to that because I need you to understand they played a little game where they combined the disability trust fund number and the old age survivor fund number. So the old age survivor was still at 2033. But then you roll in disability, actually, because so many people are able to work in the new economy. Its number was better, so they combined the two, and that's where you really got some of the added time on the trust fund. Yay!
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
You know, that was clear from the beginning.
House Ag Committee Chairman G.T. Thompson agrees current budget and debt situation playing a role in the farm bill.
Although we needed to do new investments, based on what we heard, there'd be no new spending. And so we had to really find funding sources within our jurisdiction of agriculture. And I'm pleased to say I've been able to do that, and do that in a way that kind of honors my previous career, which was in healthcare, where I was in preparing to provide healthcare. It was kind of drilled into me, do no harm. And so the pay-fors that we found are actually adequate. They're really going to allow us to do, to make this a highly effective and transformational farm bill. But it really does no harm in those areas. So in the areas of the Inflation Reduction Act, the Thrifty Food Plan, evaluation process, and that, you know, that won't, and also then in really looking at dollars in terms of from the Congressional Budget Office, making sure that they get an accurate cost of these programs. None of that does any harm to conservation, to nutrition, or quite frankly, programs like the Commodity Credit Corporation, which is so important that we have. We do no harm to that, but we're able to find the adequate funding. It's kind of win-win.
Dairy industry has been a priority.
Oh, we are, in a rather robust way, actually. Obviously, we're strengthening the dairy margin coverage program, and we're doing that by increasing the pounds from 5 million to 6. That's important, especially as we've lost dairy farms The surrounding dairy farms have kind of absorbed some of those cows, and they've increased their production. That tends to happen when you get a consolidation. So increasing that limit, we're modernizing the data. So the feed costs, which now, dates back to 2012, we're going to be using more current real-time data to be able to look at the cost of that feed. And that's a variable that we use with what has been very, very popular, the dairy margin coverage. I have gotten a waiver from the Education Workforce Committee, so we will be attaching a bill that was my bill that passed out of the House with 331 votes, the Whole Milk for Healthy Kids, which really addresses, first of all, our youth in school getting access to the most nutritional beverage, so it's good for their health. At the same time, it's a great market opportunity, right? And so it will expand the recapture market that we've lost, going back to 2009, 2010. And then there's some incentive programs in terms of nutrition. There's just a lot in there that'll be, it's good news and overdue news for our dairy industry.
Said really he had a lot of help writing the farm bill.
It's the world's largest advisory group because it's farmers and ranchers and folks, processors all over the country, right? With the listening sessions and the portals that we've had, I describe it as being tripartisan. So they're baked into this chairman's mark, which we will mark up starting Thursday morning. You will find legislation that is led by Republicans, by Democrats, and quite frankly, ideas that were put forward just from the industry itself. The things that we heard when we did all these listening sessions, the things that people identified as we were out talking with people, about what their ideas, what were their priorities, because their priorities need to be our priorities, those hardworking families that provide us food and fiber, building material, and energy resources, and the ones that process them as well.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Global corn balance sheet.
Speaking recently as they unveiled the latest monthly World Ag Supply Demand Estimates Report, Dr. Mark Chekanowski, Chairman of USDA's World Ag Outlook Board.
Back year, real quick, the only thing I'll note here on the back year is global corn trade. A little bit lower exports out of Argentina and Brazil, given their smaller crops, but partially offset by higher exports from the U.S. and Ukraine. Raised Ukraine's corn exports again. Now we're at 26 million tons. That's up 1.5 million tons from last 1.5 million tons from last month. New crop year production. Production down, mentioned that on an earlier slide, led by lower production in the U.S., Argentina, and Ukraine. Feed use up a bit, up fairly strongly. That's higher feed use in the U.S., China, Brazil, and India. In terms of foreign trade, we're expecting higher exports. Higher exports from the U.S., lower exports from Brazil, Ukraine, and India. Ukraine exports for next year were forecast at 24 million tons, so that's down 2 million year over year. Again, U.S. up a bit. So speaking of the U.S., real quick on the back year, so the crop currently being marketed, raised our ethanol. Corn use for ethanol forecast 50 million bushels, seeing some fairly strong exports and also good blending economics. Relatively cheap corn prices, relatively high gasoline prices, so blending economics are good for ethanol. So seeing some growth in the data there. Exports, picking up a little bit of export business in the past few weeks reflected there. Slow start to Argentina and Brazil, giving some opportunities for the U.S. on those old crop sales. Prices down 5 cents per bushel this month, again on the old crop. That's just reflecting prices to date, updating based on prices to date. And now moving into the new crop year, 24-25, again, acreage area out of prospective plantings, the March report, adopted the trend yields reported during the AOF yields there. And with that, you can see, fairly strong reduction in production, but an increase in beginning stocks, leaving total supplies up a bit year over year. Exports up, forecast higher for the U.S., fewer exports from Ukraine in the fall, giving us a little bit more opportunity there. Season average market price next year, anticipated to be down 25 cents a bushel lower than the current forecast for the current crop year.
World Ag Outlook Board Chairman Mark Jackanowski. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
If the U.S. economy is about $28, $29 trillion, and we're going to borrow this year, publicly borrow, not total borrow, publicly borrow maybe $2.7, $2.8 trillion, you're functionally borrowing, what, 9% of the entire economy? That's remarkable.
Arizona Representative David Schweikert.
I'm hoping I'm wrong. CBO thought we'd only be about 5.4%. But if you look at our current burn rate, the concept, and why that's important. Remember, I've come here and done the presentation of the left's version of, let's tax people over 400,000. You do it and you say, okay, there's this concept of tax maximization where I can tax your income to a certain point, but the next percent of tax on you, it rolls over. You actually say, screw it, I'm not going to work as much. It's basically a concept based off sort of the Laffer curve concept. But you can get the same thing in capital gains. How much of capital gains today is just inflation? It's not actually appreciation of your asset. It's inflation changes of your asset. Estate taxes, your pass-throughs, all those things. And the math came out to about 1.5, 1.6% of GDP you could get by taxing those, tax maximizing everything for those over $400,000. Play this math with me. If it's 1.5% of the economy and you have a year, so far this year, we're borrowing over 9% of the economy. Does that give you an idea? And those of us who want to cut spending, if you're not allowed to touch defense and if you're not allowed to touch any of that mandatory I just showed you, you have the non-defense discretionary spending that, what was it? Let's call it $900 billion. Can you get 1% of GDP? 1.5? Yeah, you could cut all sorts of programs. Remember, the Bloomberg economists a year ago put out a report saying if you took $100 billion out of non-defense discretionary, you actually lower GDP about 0.5%. So everyone who says, we're going to cut and we're going to pretend the economy is going to grow at this rate, that's not how the math works. Now, in the long run, you have more capital stock, those things. But in the short run, you actually lower GDP with these cuts. You just got to deal with it. It's the reality of economics and math.
But what about extending tax cuts? Alan Auerbach is a professor and economist at UC Berkeley.
The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And so this is from a recent, from last week, the document, the updated estimates that CBO produced of the cost of extending the provisions of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. If you add it all up, so not just the individual provisions, if you add it all up, it's about $4.5 trillion. And, if you look at the national debt projected in the CBO baseline through 2034, this would represent close to a 10% increase in the national debt relative to the baseline. So this is not a small difference. And we need to keep in mind, as Phil pointed out, that the difference of opinion in Washington in terms of what to do about the Tax and Jobs Act isn't should we have a tax increase or extend a tax cut. It's what fraction of the tax cut is going to be extended, more than half or all. And, in recent history, when there are differences of opinion in Washington, everybody can agree on a tax cut. And so I think you, regardless of the configuration of government after the election, I think you need to expect, we should expect a substantial tax cut, at least measured relative to the baseline. And so that is already going to put you well above the CBO baseline, holding everything else fixed.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The amount of requests and amount of work continues to go up. The number of employers is going down. And so we've been really challenged on how we work with the publics going forward.
Randy Moore is chief of the U.S. Forest Service.
And so while we've created a lot of really great relationships through partners and through our community leaders, we really needed to beef up just the basic bare bone of the organization. And so Bill and Ira has allowed us to do that. And now that we have beefed it up, you know, our goal, we lost 40% of a non-fire workforce over the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. And our ideal was to bring back half of that and then leverage the other half through partnerships. I'm happy to say that last year, when we look at partner contributions to what we've been able to do, they contribute about $970 million worth of value to the work that we do because of that leveraging.